But I don't know about you, but I find this psalm quite difficult. I think it's a tough psalm. Even though it's a favourite amongst many of us, I'm sure, and on the surface it doesn't seem too complex or too hard to follow. It's not too long, it's full of familiar, well-quoted verses. But despite all that, I still think it's difficult. And the reason I think it's difficult is that right from the outset, that the claim that this psalm makes is absolutely audacious. I don't know if it's ever struck you before, but at the beginning of verse 2, the psalmist makes an absolutely outrageous claim. Look there at the beginning of verse 2. The psalmist makes this statement as bold as a lion. He says, "Therefore we will not fear." And then, far from caveating or limiting the scope of such a bold claim, he actually, as we'll see, he goes on to claim that in all circumstances, and even the worst circumstances, this statement still holds true. "Therefore we will not fear." And it's an audacious claim because I guess it's no exaggeration to say that fear is something we're all used to in our lives. It's one of the most primal experiences of the human race, isn't it? One of the first things we feel is fear, the fear of a child who loses grip on their mum's hand in the crowd or can't get to sleep without the nightlight on. And we can see that fear then grows and develops as our responsibilities and relationships grow and develop throughout our lives. The fact is we're used to fear. We live in what is often a scary, unpredictable world that makes us well acquainted with the experience of being afraid. But nevertheless, the outrageous claim of this psalm is that it is possible for us to be unafraid. In the midst of a scary, scary world, it is possible to drive fear away. And so I want us to spend some time looking this evening at how the psalmist can make such a bold claim, and how we can come to know and experience something of the experience he's describing here in our lives. And we'll do that by looking firstly at two pictures that the psalmist gives us, two places that he describes for us, one a place of fear and the other a place of refuge and security. And then we'll conclude by looking at how we can move from the first place to the second, from the place of fear to the place of security. So then, two pictures that the psalmist gives us. And the first picture is the picture of the raging storm. We see it there in verses 2 and 3. In verse 2, the psalmist, as I say, he goes on to describe the circumstances which surround that bold statement at the beginning of the verse. And the circumstances he describes make it appear even more of an outrageous claim. Let's look at verses 2 and 3 again. It says, "Therefore we will not fear, though the earth give way, and the mountains fall into the heart of the sea. Though its waters roar and foam, and the mountains quake with their surging." In these verses, the psalmist builds up a picture of what can only be described as the most violent, destructive storm imaginable. It's not clear what instruments would have been used to accompany the singing of this psalm. The note at the top refers to an alamoth. If anyone knows what that is, then they can tell me later. But from the content of these verses 2 and 3, some crashing cymbals, maybe some thunderous drums, probably wouldn't have gone amiss, would they? These verses are loud. They're dramatic. The picture is of water surging, the earth itself collapsing, even the mountains dissolving like sandcastles into the furious sea. And the first thing for us to notice here is that the storm that rages in these verses is one that demolishes strongholds. For us today, mountains, well, they're nice to look at, aren't they? Nice to walk up, for some people anyway, probably not me. And we'd certainly be more than a little concerned if we saw them being demolished in the way that's described in this psalm. But for the people who originally sang this psalm, mountains meant much more than just that. For them, mountains were a place of refuge, a safe haven, a position of military strength. In the time of Gideon in the book of Judges, we're told that the Israelites hid from the invading Midianites in the mountains. They were places of security where people would flee when nowhere else was secure. So begin to see then what the point of this picture is that the psalmist is painting for us. For the original singers of this psalm, this picture of the mountains falling into the sea wasn't just a description of some great ecological disaster. It's a picture of their security being stripped away, their refuges being blown away by the power of a raging storm. For us today, I guess mountains are probably more symbolic of exposure and danger than refuge and safety. But let's not, because of that, miss the points beneath the picture here. The point is that there's a storm that rages in this world, a storm that's raging even now. And that storm has more than enough power to demolish the strongholds in our lives. That's the frightening picture that's built here. Even the most stable, secure, enduring, constant foundations in our lives, the places, the people, the things we run to in crisis, the things that are the bedrock of our security, that carry the weight of all our dependence, those things that we live our lives utterly reliant on them always being there, even those strongholds aren't sufficient to stand in the face of this storm. And that's why this storm is so terrifying. That's what provokes the fear that the psalmist talks about in verse 2. Not just some natural disaster, but the threatening of our strongholds, our mountains. And the truth is, we all have these mountains, the places where we invest our security. Think of the one thing that you're absolutely terrified of losing. The one thing that if everything else was stripped away, you'd get through because you still have it. But if that one thing was stripped away, having everything else could never console you. It might be your family, your children, your spouse, your future spouse, your health, your beauty, your reputation for being hardworking or humorous or holy. It might be your career prospects, your intelligence, your financial stability, maybe your retirement dreams and the pension to fund them with, or the success of your particular ministry in the church. All of us have these strongholds. And you notice the thing about these strongholds is that the more we invest our security in them, the more we grow to depend on them and need them. The more they become the basis of our hope and that central fixation of our hearts, then understandably, the more we're terrified of losing them. But the scary point of the raging storm is that those strongholds can't stand up under the weight of dependence that we place on them, because they can't withstand the surging power of the storm. Reality is that we live in a stormy world. A world where health is unstable, where beauty fades, where reputations are damaged, where redundancy crushes career prospects, where children grow up and spouses disappoint us, where relationships don't always work out, where intellect fails, where markets crash, and success can so easily and so quickly turn into failure. We live in a scary world where the storm rages. And even the seemingly most stable, most secure, most dependable strongholds can in a moment come crashing into the heart of the sea. Well, it's a frightening and ominous picture, isn't it? And I'm sorry to say that for those of you who want some respite from the storm already, well, we're not quite done with it yet. Because as well as destroying our strongholds, we can see also that this storm exposes our frailty. Something else that comes across very strongly in the scene of these verses is that this storm is way, way beyond our control. See this in the language of verse 3 especially. The words there translated as roar and foam, they give us a sense of this. The word for foam literally means to boil up, like water boiling up out of control. The picture that's built up is one of uncontrollable, untamable power Even the mountains quake with the surging power of these waters. The storm is beyond our control, and everyone and everything is subject to its whim. Far from us controlling the storm has the power to control us. I don't think it's unfair to say that most of the time we live our lives as if we're the ones who are in control. It's true, isn't it? It's certainly true of me. That's the premise on which I so often make my decisions, plan my day, my week, my year, my life. As if nothing can thwart my plans, as if the storm is under my control. This morning I didn't eat breakfast. I know it's the most important meal of the day. I can already see the look of horror on your faces. I'm still alive, I've survived, it's okay. But I decided that I didn't really want to have any breakfast. At least I decided that of the various, tragically not that various, options available in the kitchen, nothing really took my fancy. The reason nothing took my fancy was probably something to do with how hungry I was or wasn't, or because I hadn't had the time or inclination to buy something I knew I liked earlier in the week, or perhaps because of what I'd eaten the night before, or the previous morning, or the night before that, or the day before that. In fact, the reason I didn't like anything in the cupboards was probably due to the cumulative experience of my taste buds over the course of about 18,000 meals I've eaten in my lifetime. Many of them, as many of you here well know, have been cooked for me. In fact, the first 10,000 were probably cooked for me by my mum. Thanks, Mum. In which case, they were influenced by my parents' tastes and by their decisions about what was good for me and what wasn't. And their tastes would have been influenced by their various culinary experiences and their parents' tastes before them and their parents' influences on them and so on. And that's not even to mention the effects on my decision this morning about breakfast of my genetic makeup, the culture I live in, the influence of the media, the scope of breakfast products available in the average British supermarket, and the amount of sleep I got last night. It's a silly example, and it's relatively insignificant, but I hope it goes some way in making the points. And the point is this, that every day, 1,000 times, even before breakfast, the universe screams to us that we're not in control. Every moment, every decision, every thought, every circumstance that confronts us is the result of hundreds of influences, hundreds of memories, hundreds of chemical reactions that are beyond the scope of our tiny sphere of autonomy. We live as if we're in control. Every day we act like we're the ones calling the shots. We live out that illusion of our own sovereignty. But it really is an illusion. So why do we do it? Why do we pretend in this way? Well, I guess the truth is we pretend because the alternative is pretty terrifying. There's nothing more terrifying than realizing that you're not in control, let alone that you're subject to the power of a storm that is powerful enough to strip away your strongholds. Many of you know I went to out to Orlando earlier in the year to visit George and Ellie, members of the church here who are living and working out there. And in between some Bible college lectures and various other things, George and I managed to squeeze in a trip to Disney. There's not much else to do in Orlando, so it's kind of a compulsory tourist trip, but I certainly wasn't complaining about that. While we were there, I managed to drag George, kicking and screaming, onto one of the rides called the Tower of Terror. I don't know if you've heard of it or perhaps even been on it. But basically, it's like a giant lift, elevator in American, which you sit in and it takes you to the top of a pretty disturbingly high tower. And then, well, you probably guessed it, it takes you back down a lot faster than you went up. Generally leaves most of your internal organs behind you in the process. But the thing which gives the Tower of Terror its terror isn't so much the speed at which you come down or the subsequent after effects that has on your digestive system. The thing that's so scary about it is that when you're at the top, you have no idea, absolutely no idea, when you are coming back down. You're left kind of hanging there, you're left guessing. You know you're going down, but you don't know when. And there's absolutely nothing you can do about it. Being out of control is scary. It can be terrifying. But despite the game of pretense that we all play every day, living as if we're in control, it's not the reality, is it? The truth is, we don't know when the phone will ring with the news we dread, or the doctor will say the words we fear most. We can't put a lid on the secret that escapes and undermines our squeaky clean reputation. We can't put the brakes on quick enough when the car in front screeches to standstill. You can't hold back the steady fade of your beauty or the downward plummet in the value of your pension funds. On a much grander and more frightening scale than the Tower of Terror, we are not in control. And this picture of the storm, this frightening picture, should make us, I think, feel our weakness. Should awaken us again to our own frailty. Should open our eyes to see that in a sense, in a very real sense, we should be a lot more afraid than we actually are. The storm rages, terrifyingly so. And there's nothing we can do to stop it. That's all pretty depressing, isn't it? Pretty scary. But there is another picture in this psalm. And it's there in verses 4 to 7. The second place that's described for us there. So let's look at verses 4 to 7. Let's read them again. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy place where the Most High dwells. God is within her. She will not fall. God will help her at break of day. Nations are in uproar. Kingdoms fall. He lifts his voice. The earth melts. The Lord Almighty is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. The second place that the psalmist describes for us is the unshakable city. And the contrast is so striking, isn't it? Verse 4 is almost bizarre in the way it brings such a stark contrast with verse 3. Verse 3, we have that raging, foaming, mountain-quaking surge of the waves, driven by that raging storm. But then in verse 4, we have a river, a refreshing river that meanders its way through that great city and brings joy and gladness to the citizens. You can imagine, again, how the instrumental accompaniment might have changed in an instant at the end of verse 3. We can see there that the musical notation, selah, however you say it, indicates a pause or a musical interlude at this point in the song. And the striking picture, the stark contrast that's drawn by the psalmist is that in the midst of this raging storm is a city that, despite the destruction taking place all around it, remains firm and unshakable. It will not fall. In fact, the picture is one even of peace and joy. The surging water of the sea is now the calm water of the river. And the stark contrast that this picture introduces, it reinforces the psalmist's audacious, outrageous claim that we saw at the beginning of verse 2. The psalmist is saying that in the midst of the storm, there is a place of peace. And the turbulence of a world, and in the face of those circumstances which strip us of the things we love most, which can rob us of all our security and expose once again our frailty, in the midst of all of that, it is possible to be without fear. When all other strongholds fall away, there is a stronghold that will never fall. In fact, the psalmist goes even further than that, because not only is this place a place of peace and refuge, but it's a place of gladness and joy. In fact, can we say that the psalmist goes even further than that? Can we say that this psalm is audacious enough to claim that the very same waters which toppled mountains, which brought down strongholds and provoked such fear in verses 2 and 3, are the same waters which bring refreshments and gladness to those who dwell in the city. In other words, what does this second picture teach us? I think it teaches us that if you are taking refuge within the walls of this unshakable city, then you will be able to face the most terrifying, heart-wrenching, devastating circumstances that this scary world can throw at you, with poise and with peace and with strength and even with joy. It's saying that if you're in the city, that the storm, far from overwhelming you, will be to you like a river which makes you glad. Though the earth gives way and the mountains fall into the heart of the sea, the citizens of this city will not fear. They're absolutely secure. The storm can't touch them. Don't you want to be like that? Don't you want to know that kind of security? Don't you want to be able to face the storm? Storm of life with that kind of strength. I know I do. Well, how can we begin to do so? Well, the psalm points to how we can move from the storm to the city. So I want us to finish by thinking about that. How can we take refuge in the city? I think the psalmist points us to a few things which help us with this. First thing we need to notice is that the city is more of a person than a place. It's not so much a where, but a who. Someone at the heart of this city who is the source of and reason for all of its strength and peace. You don't need me to tell you who that is. Verse 4, the city of God, the holy place where the Most High dwells. Verse 5, God is within her, she will not fall. God will help her at break of day. Verse 7, the Lord Almighty is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. If we want to take refuge in the unshakable city of God, then we need to take refuge in the unshakable God of the city. We need to take refuge in Him. And to set us on the path to doing that, the psalmist points us to two things about this God. Two things which, to the extent these things are written on our hearts, we will be unshakable. So the psalmist points us, he draws us, he calls us to, firstly, the perspective of the Lord of the storm, and secondly, the love of the Lord in the storm. Firstly, then, the perspective of the Lord of the storm. In verse 6, the psalmist begins to give us some vivid descriptions of the power and strength of God. But the striking thing about verse 6, I don't know if you noticed this when Dan read it for us, but the striking thing is the parallels between this verse and the description of the storm then in verses 2 and 3. Look at the words that the psalmist uses. In verse 2, we're told that the storm causes mountains to fall. And then in verse 6, we're told that kingdoms fall. It's the same words in both. And in verse 3, the waters roar. And then in verse 6, the nations are in uproar. Again, it's the same word there as well. In verse 2, the earth gives way. And then in verse 6, the earth melts. Same words again. Why these parallels? What's the psalmist getting across? Well, I think he's getting across that the storm which rages so far beyond our control is not out of control. Because behind and over and above the storm that causes mountains to fall and waters to roar and the earth to give way is the one who causes kingdoms to fall and nations to roar. The one who simply by lifting his voice melts the earth. The storm is not out of control because there is a Lord of the storm who has it under control. And that's a clear theme throughout the psalm as well, isn't it? Not just in verse 6. We see it particularly in verse 10 at the end of the psalm. However strong the storm is, the Lord of the storm is stronger. However far the storm is beyond our control, it's not beyond His control. In fact, it's completely under His control. The psalmist then goes on in verses 8 to 10 to tell us more than that. Not only do we see that the storm is under God's control, but we see that God knows exactly what he's doing. We see that he exercises that control with purpose. From inside the storm, from the perspective of verses 2 and 3, that the storm looks a bit like chaos, doesn't it? The earth giving way, mountains quaking and falling. It looks bad. It looks like it's out to get us. It looks completely random and without purpose. And isn't that often how it feels as well? Isn't that what it feels like when things go wrong, when the storm strikes us? Even though we know, particularly as good Reformed evangelicals, we know, don't we, that God is in control. I guess if we're honest, we look at the storm and we think, perhaps too often, that we could probably do a better job of controlling it ourselves. We feel like that, don't we, sometimes? We can't understand why it always happens to us and never to them. And we can think of 1,000 good reasons for it not happening like it did. 1,000 bad consequences of it happening like it did. Although we know that God is in control, it just doesn't feel like he is. Or at least if he is, then he doesn't really seem to know what he's doing. Well, in verses 8 to 10, the psalmist helps us with this. Because what he does in those verses is to call us to come and see the storm from a different perspective. From the perspective of the Lord of the storm. He beckons us to come and to look and to see. And what he gives us is a view across the whole panorama of history. Look at what he says in verses 8 and 9. He says, come and see the works of the Lord, the desolations he has brought on the earth. He makes wars cease to the ends of the earth. He breaks the bow and shatters the spear. He burns the shields with fire. In these verses, the psalmist beckons us to come and look at the whole vista of history from a new vantage point. And what do we see? Well, what we see and what the psalmist describes here is the Lord of the storm bringing order out of the chaos of the storm. We see peace being brought out of conflict. We see wars ceasing. We see armies being disarmed. And then in verse 10, we hear the voice of the Lord of the storm. And what do we hear? We hear him bellowing this awesome decree over all of history. Often we take these words as words of comfort spoken to God's people. But I think the context tells us that primarily these are words of command. The Lord of the storm is issuing his orders. And his orders are this. His orders are, be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. What's going on here? What's the Lord of the storm doing? What's he doing? Well, he's stilling all of the storms. He's stilling the storms. That the panorama of history that the psalmist shows us in these verses points us to this fact, that the Lord of the storm is weaving together everything in all of history. From the tiniest movements at the subatomic level to currency negotiations at the G20 summit, he's weaving everything together to culminate in a day when everything sad will come untrue, when all evil and pain will be unraveled, when every storm will be stilled, and when his glorious, perfect name will be exalted among all the nations of the earth. He's going to still all the storms. And he's already working all of history towards that glorious, inevitable end. But still we look around us, don't we? We look around and say, well, I can't really see it myself. Great plan. 10 out of 10 for intention, but there's quite a lot of work that needs doing here, really. if anything, we've taken a few backward steps on the route of his purpose in the last year. But did you ever stop to think that this glorious plan, this plan behind every other plan, this plan for the whole direction of history, begins with you, begins with us, begins with the people of God? What if God's plan to still all the storms begins with creating a people who are so deep-rooted in Him in the midst of the storm raging around them that they become rocks and hiding places for those around them because they point them to the only true rock and hiding place? What if God's plan to bring about peace begins with creating a nation of peacemakers who are so at peace on the insides when war and conflicts and disputes and arguments rages on the outside, that they're people who diffuse arguments, take the heat out of every conflict they encounter, and spread a contagious gentleness in a world of harshness? What if God's plan to exalt His name among all the nations of the earth begins in the hearts and minds of a people who are so radically transformed, so radically renewed in their perspective on the storm, that they don't just praise Him when things are good and blame Him when things are bad, but they exalt His name when things are good and when things are bad? Well, it turns out that that's exactly what the Bible tells us His plan is. His plan starts with us. It starts with His people. It starts with you and with me. It starts with us having our perspective so radically transformed in this way, that we become rocks in the midst of the storm. Ever noticed how small children often choose the strangest things to be their favourite toys? I'm sure you all used to have an embarrassingly strange toy when you were younger. Maybe it was just me, but I used to have a teddy called Old Teddy. I think he's probably still alive somewhere. But he was called Old Teddy because he was old, not very imaginative. And he was probably the most ugly, battered old piece of stuffed bear you've ever seen. I think he even had to have an arm transplant at one point. Things got so bad. But I loved him. I took him everywhere with me. His face was all squashed from me sleeping on top of him every night. We're talking years ago here, not just a few months ago, by the way, in case you're wondering. But if you'd have come up to a five-year-old me and offered me £100 in return for Old Teddy, maybe you'd discovered he was part of some antique bear collection or something like that. Well, what do you think I'd have said? Of course I'd have said, no way. I'd probably screamed and cried as part of the bargain as well. And if you'd have insisted on taking him away from me, or my parents would have insisted on making a quick cash return, well, I'd have been devastated, wouldn't I? I'd have been gutted. I'd probably have cried for days. And I'd have cried not because some great injustice had been committed against me, not because I'd got a raw deal, because the antique teddy bear man had somehow ripped me off. I'd have cried because my perspective was distorted. To me, an old piece of stuffed material in the shape of a bear, albeit with some pretty heavy sentimental strings attached, to me that was the most important thing in the world. Nothing else mattered more. Of course, now I'd be more than happy for someone to take him off my hands for considerably less than £100. I guess, unfortunately, it's probably too late now to convince any of you that he is a genuine antique. But you see, now my perspective's changed. I've grown up. My vantage point is different. I look at the storm of the loss of Old Teddy in a different kind of way. I don't want to trivialise the difficulties we face in life. Some of you, probably most of you in this room, have been through really difficult experiences, far more than anything I've ever been through. And you've perhaps live with the ongoing pain of those experiences for years, perhaps even decades. Some of you have even gone through them this week or this month. But isn't it true that so often we go through life thinking our big problem, our main problem, is these difficulties, that our problem is the storm, that if only God would take away our problems, if only the pain would go away, if only the sickness or the emotional turmoil or the financial troubles would end, then that would be the best thing. Then we'd be all right. Then everything would be all right. But the perspective of the Lord of the storm tells us that the problem isn't the storm. The best thing was for God to take away the storm. Well, he would have done that already. But that's not the best thing, because the problem isn't the storm. The problem is correcting our perspective on the storm. It's our vantage point that's wrong. We could see, if we caught a glimpse of the tremendous purposes which God is working out in us and in the universe through the power of the storm, we'd see that the Lord of the storm is in control and he knows exactly what he's doing. And that would change us. It would make us strong. It would give us such deep roots that we would become unshakable. C.S. Lewis, who understood far more about these things than I do, he put it like this. He says, when a man turns to Christ and seems to be getting on pretty well, he often feels that it would now be natural if things went fairly smoothly. When troubles come along, illnesses, money troubles, new kinds of temptation, he's disappointed. These things, he feels, might have been necessary to rouse him and make him repent in his bad old days, but why now? Because God is forcing him on, or up, to a higher level, putting him into situations where he will have to be very much braver, or more patient, or more loving than he ever dreamed of being before. Seems to us all unnecessary, but that is because we have not yet had the slightest notion of the tremendous thing he means to make of us. If we let him, he will make the feeblest and filthiest of us into a dazzling, radiant, immortal creature, pulsating all through with such energy and joy and wisdom and love as we cannot now imagine. A bright, stainless mirror which reflects back to God perfectly, though of course on a smaller scale, his own boundless power and delight and goodness. The process will be long and in parts very painful, but that is what we are in for, nothing less. The perspective of the Lord of the storm tells us that he's in control and he knows what he's doing. It tells us that he always gives us what we would have wanted if only we knew as much as he does. If only we could see what he's doing in us and in the universe. If only we could see that he's going to still every storm. He's going to exalt his name in all the nations of the earth. And he's starting with us. Well, secondly, and finally, as well as the perspective of the Lord of the storm, we need to know the love of the Lord in the storm. In 1 John 4, the Apostle John talks about a perfect love which drives out fear. If we're to know the refuge of the unshakable city of God, then it's that love that we need to know as well. How can we know that love? Where do we see it? We see it in the midst of another storm, hundreds of years later, where again the Lord of the storm cries out, "Be still," and the storm is silent. But the difference between the storm here in Psalm 46 and this other storm, the astonishing, breathtaking difference, is that in that second storm, that the Lord of the storm, the one who for all eternity has been bringing order out of chaos, weaving every circumstance, every decision, every detail towards his own matchless exaltation among all the nations of the earth. In this other storm, the Lord of the storm enters into the storm himself. The Lord of the storm becomes the Lord in the storm. He enters into the storm as he takes on all the frailty and weakness of you and I. As he willingly shrinks his sphere of control and exposes himself to all the battering and suffering and insecurity of a scary, scary world. He enters into the storm as he allows it to strip him of all the shaky vestiges of security that this world offers. As he lives without riches or power or prospects, without anything in his appearance that people should desire him, as friends and family desert and disown him. And finally, he enters into the storm as he goes outside the city to face the ultimate storm, the storm of all storms. And the descending of the darkness, the shaking of the earth, and the splitting of the rocks only point to that final hellish storm, as the one who for all eternity had rested in the refuge of his Father is abandoned with no refuge, no security, no help. The writer to the Hebrews tells us that Jesus suffered outside the city gate to make the people holy through his own blood. And to the extent that we know that Jesus gave up the security of the city of God, the endless security of his Father's side, so that we can be eternally secure. To the extent that we see that he took on himself the only storm that could hurt us forever, so that we don't have to. To the extent that we know that we're loved with such a perfect, costly, eternal, unconditional, secure, relentless love as this. To the extent that this perfect love is emblazoned on our hearts and is the bedrock of our lives, to that extent we will become unshakable. We'll be fearless in the face of the raging storm. There is no security like the security of the love of the Lord in the storm. What will that fearlessness of those who take on this refuge in the unshakable city, what will it look like? Well, it will be a visible fearlessness. Jesus tells us that a city on a hill cannot be hidden. The city of God and those who are secure within it will stand out. Having this kind of poise and peace and strength in the face of tragedy and suffering and loss, in both the big things and the small things, that will shine brightly in a world where beneath the surface, everyone's scared of losing something. Everyone's frail. Storm exposes everyone's frailty and everyone's desperately looking for this kind of security. And it will be a liberating fearlessness. Because you see that resting in the security of the unshakable city means that we're set free to let those other mountains fall. It means that in a sense, we can let our old strongholds go. In a sense, we can be reckless with them because we have the only stronghold that will last forever. It sets us free to be generous with our money, with our possessions, with our homes, because, well, they're not our strongholds anymore. It liberates us in our friends and relationships. We're free to befriend the unpopular, the unbeautiful, the ones who don't fit in with the image we always wanted to portray. Because, well, our reputation isn't our stronghold anymore. It sets us free from maintaining that polished reputation. It liberates us to be honest with each other in the church, to drop the pretense and to be real about our struggles and our weaknesses. It sets us free to give all of our lives in every aspect, in the reckless, dangerous pursuits of the only cause that will last forever, the exaltation of the Lord of the storm in all the nations of the earth. Because in the end, nothing else matters more than that.